Hello and welcome to White Line Wireless's continuing coverage of the Australian Imperial Force 11 tour. My name's Anthony Condon and joining me this week is Russ Degnan. Hi Russ.
Hi Ant.
So for those of you who aren't 100% sure what we're doing here, we're going through reading these fake tour diaries from a journalist called Cow Corner. So you've got to pretend that this is like an embedded journalist with the military cricket team touring around at the end of World War One. Now, the journalist is fake. Most of the words are true. I have got them out of old newspaper reports, war diaries, those kind of things, and cut them together, bricolage style. Put them up on my website, anthonycondon.com. Well, you can go along and when you mouse over real stuff that I've used, the actual newspaper article will jump out from the page and you can read it there. A lot of times you can click through and read the newspaper itself. So playing around with just some interactive history presentation. Today we have the very last of the diaries to come out of England. Our lads are about to get on a boat and sail to South Africa. So there's no actual cricket this week. This week, we just have essentially the send-off dinner. I'm going to read through Cow Corner's diary, which is largely made up of speeches from the dinner. So you'll be able to... Yeah, so I think I'm just going to jump in because there's plenty of places to stop and chat with this. So here is Cow Corner's diary. Last Monday evening, we were the guests at a representatively attended dinner at the Cafe Monaco, Piccadilly Circus, with Messrs. J. Wisdom and Company as hosts. In the company, which numbered about 100, were many who must be regarded as shining lights in the cricket world. Now, I'm about to give you many, many names. So, a lot of the times I would have cut this out. So, I could have done this many times so far. But I cut it out because it's just, you know, a bunch of names. I wanted to leave it in this one because this is the most significant bunch of names, but I also just wanted to give an example that this was really common at the time, how you would write about this kind of function. You would say, I went to this, you know, I'm reporting on this dinner, and here are all the important people that were there. It's very important to say, you know, this is the, especially aristocracy is this, very much the main one in a lot of cases. And a lot of 19th century cricket reports in Australia, it's very interesting to read them, especially when England's touring, because it really is a chance for all of the important people in the colony to come out and get together and get some prestige off the cricketers. So there is a lot of that going on. There's a shared transfer of prestige from the cricket team to the important people and vice versa. And then they just have a lot of people that they've met along the way and have something to do with the team. So what we're going to do is go through and keep reading Cow Corner's diary, and we'll pick out some of these names that are noteworthy. So first of all, the Right Honourable Lord Harris, who successfully captained England v Australia in the first Test match in this country 39 years ago, occupied the chair, having on his right the colonial skipper, Mr H.L. Collins, the Honourable F.S. Jackson, M.P., Lord Burnham, Brigadier General C.H. Jess, C.M.G., D.S.O., Lieutenant Colonel C.V. Watson, D.S.O., Lieutenant Colonel T.S. Woodburn, C.B.E. So that's just who's sitting on his right. So military top brass, and then also Lord Harris, who's, so he was the, I think he was the president of the MCC at this stage. Think so. Might have just finished or just started, but around this stage he is, yeah, one of the bosses.
It's certainly someone who'd been around cricket for a very long time.
Very long time. Like I said, you know, first Test captain of England.
F.S. Jackson as well. Captained England, I think, in the 1890s or maybe earlier. It's always interesting to see, and we'll see with some of the other names on this list, players who on the scorecard are listed as by their name and as gentlemen, and then down the track you see them listed as, particularly if they're tour managers, beyond that as MPs or lords or the establishment arm of English cricket has always been very tightly connected to the establishment of the House of Parliament.
Yes, absolutely. And that's a key point that I really want to sort of bring up through this. So for example, I came across a newspaper article the other day from 1858, I think, or thereabouts, but they used to actually have a government versus opposition cricket match at Lord's each year. So that sort of shows you the, yeah. And one thing I'm doing for my book, which I can't tell you because I haven't done enough research at the moment, but I'm going through and looking at the people who were like on the committee at Lord's and seeing, trying to find who are the, because they're all politicians, because this is a time when the House of Lords was the House of Lords. It wasn't an elected body. It was all, and so the crossover between the House of Lords and Lords, the cricket ground, is very high. It's very high. But yeah, going through and seeing, but yeah, there's some, you know, some cabinet ministers and that kind of thing. So there was a very, and not just, and from all parties as well, which is something that I think is worth noting. Especially 19th century before you have Labour parties, when you've got Liberals and Conservatives and Whigs. So they're all, they're all sort of getting together at Lords and
players.
Yeah.
Or gentlemen, more specifically.
I was going to say capital P players. So no, but gentlemen.
Gentlemen, yeah. But playing cricket and then becoming, using that those connections to push their own political careers and so forth as they move forward.
Yeah, absolutely. It definitely would have been a site of patronage. You know, you would have been going along to Lords to. It's like when I'm reading about these early professional 11s, or All England, United, All England, that kind of thing. What you hear a lot in people complaining about them is, so one of the reasons why these were going to ruin cricket and it was going to be the end of cricket, because that is the most common story in cricket. One of the reasons why the early professionals were going to ruin cricket was because they weren't playing at Lords, because these 11s would go around and play 22s from the districts. You know, you didn't, there weren't actually that many big games, as you would call them. Most of the professional games were against nowhere, you know, or, you know, 22 from Muggleton kind of thing. And what was going to ruin cricket with these professional 11s is that the young guys coming through would, as soon as they were showing any skill, they'd be straight into a professional 11, which means they would never play at Lords. And how on earth could you possibly build a reputation that people would be willing to come and pay to see if you hadn't played at Lords? And it's really something they are saying without irony, without any sort of joke, that the belief is that 10 years after the start of the professional teams, because there wouldn't have been anyone at Lords, no one would be watching cricket anymore, because they hadn't seen these guys come up through Lords, and so then they wouldn't be going to see them play in the professional sides, and so no one would be watching cricket anymore, and so there'd be no more cricket.
So, yes, it's the view that Lords is, in fact, all of the cricket world.
Yeah.
Which sometimes, it's declined maybe in the recent years, but you could still see remnants of it around.
The cricket's over.
No, the cricket is entirely played within Lords and nowhere else.
Oh, right, yeah. Yeah, no, I think the BCCI with the Star Cash, I think, have managed to pull some of the sway away from the MCC, but that's about all. So we mentioned F.S. Jackson. He was indeed, don't think he was captain of England, but played 20 tests. He did captain England in 1905, won an Ashes, drew an Ashes to retain. So he has that behind him. And yeah, he was a Conservative Party politician. So that sort of goes to that story as well. But also when writing this, I'm like, do I keep all their post-nominals in there as well? And I'm like, yeah, I'll keep them in there. There's a lot of post-nominals in this, which is the letters after the name. So yeah, these guys are all, so DSOs, Distinguished Service Order, CBE, Commander of British Empire, that kind of thing. All right. So that's on Harris's right. To his left, we have Captain P.F. Warner, Sir Jeremiah Coleman, who's the president of Surrey County Cricket Club, Mr. Howard Lacey, the Australian manager, Senator Pierce, who we spoke about last week, Australian Defence Minister, Lieutenant Colonel, I think last week I said he was Foreign Minister, but I'm pretty sure he's Defence Minister. And we also have Lieutenant Colonel N. Marshall, DSO, Major S.A. Middleton, DSO, Captain F. Angel, and Lieutenant Colonel E.H.G. Clark, M.C.
Obviously, Plum Warner's the first name that, on that list and the one that stands out as someone who had such an important role in cricket across, again, many years. He's kind of the Harris's successor in a way.
Absolutely. He is, yeah. So he does take over. I think he's secretary to Harris's presidency for a while. And Lacey is in that managing committee of Lords at that time as well. But yeah, Plum Warner is very, very, Harris is really important for international cricket because of all the stuff he did in India. He had a lot to do with getting the maiden outside the Bombay barracks set up so the cricket could be played there and keeping the polo players away a bit, which becomes sort of the centre of where Parsi cricket, that's the genesis of Indian cricket. So he had a lot to do with cricket becoming a big thing in India. But Plum Warner is really, really important for international cricket. He really, really, really rated the importance of Australia and England, of that contest. He was central to getting this tour up and running. It was his energy that really helped. He was part of the initial organising committee. He was there during the original selection trials. It's actually Plum Warner who discovers Jack Gregory. So, you know, comes over to the Australian selectors and goes, you might want to go and have a look at this guy over here. Not knowing he was a Gregory, by the way. He just said, go have a look at the streak bowling over there. And they go over and they're like, oh, what's your name, son? And he goes, Jack Gregory. And they're like, not one of the Gregorys, are you? And he's like, yeah, I'm one of the Gregorys. So, Plum Warner, real, real important there.
Yeah. Former captain, of course, he wrote the Tour Diaries of Australia, which helped promote those tours as a big thing. And then, of course, he was the manager on the Bodyline Series, which...
I didn't realise that. I tend to get a little bit faded after the 20s.
He's a massive hypocrite. Yeah. Because he was someone who was writing letters back to the MCC saying, nah, it's all about board.
Yeah, right.
At the same time going to talk to Woodfull in this room and saying, oh, are you okay? And that's why it was to Plum Warner that Woodfull made that very famous comment because they knew that Warner was writing these articles and was being questioned in the press about why have you said Bodyline in the press originally is not a good thing, but then telling Lords that it is a good thing and then asking us whether it's okay, like you're just trying to play every side here. So Warner's a really interesting figure in that series, obviously, 15, 13 years hence.
The thing that jumps into my head when you're talking about this is it's my very nature that I always frame Bodyline as a political event. That's what I find it most interesting. In context of the Balfour Declaration, Statute of Westminster, Australian Dominionship, it's all tied up with that, and that it also really helps to explain why Don Bradman's such an icon and 1930s Australian political context is very important to understand that whole story, and it gets left out a lot. It's interesting that you bring up that Plum Warner was playing that role, because we're showing here these connections between the cricket elite in England and the politicians, and how important that is. But so I'm just looking up George Pierce's record, because I'm interested in what he's doing in the 30s, because, you know, we have Senator Pierce here sitting next to Plum Warner, and he... Yeah, so he's in office. He was a senator till 1938, so he would have been a senator at that time. But which party was he? He did start off Labor, and he ends up... Okay, yeah, so he goes over to United Australia Party with Lyons. Yeah, but he didn't back Hughes. Okay, so he wasn't on the Billy Hughes side of things. So, yeah, so Pierce was more of a nationalist. So he was, yeah... Which is interesting. So he would have been more in Australia. He would have been more on Australia's side than England's side. So I wonder if there's some Senator Pierce and Plum Warner discussions during the Bodyline tour, because they definitely know each other. So they're not sitting next to each other. They've got Jeremiah Coleman, the president of Surrey, and Howard Lacey in between them. Okay. Others present, in addition to the whole of the Australian team, were Colonel Sir H.G. Norris, NP, Reverend F.H. Gillingham, who's come up previously, Colonel K.G. Brooke, Captain S.D. Harawa, Lieutenant Colonel C.S. Griffiths, M.C., Major Honourable L.H. Tennyson, who's come up before, Major J.W. H.T. Douglas, Messrs. R.H. Spooner, W. Finlay, who's the Secretary of Surrey, J.R. Mason, W. Hall, Lieutenant Colonel L.H.W. Trofton, Messrs. G.A. Fairburn, T. Pawley, H.L. Wilson, F.S. Ashley Cooper, H.V.L. Stanton, who is Wanderer, he's a journalist, wrote under Wanderer, so if you're reading maybe Bell's Life, I think, in 1919, you come up him, that's him, Major B.C. Hartley, Captain N.E. Haig, Messrs. J.N. Crawford, R.M. Bell, H.T.W. Hardinger, J.E. Woolley, G. Gunn, J.B. Hobbs, J.W. Hearn, E.H. Hendren, etc.
I like that they finish with the cricketers who are present, who are the huge names in the history of cricket.
Yeah.
You know, Woolley, Hobbs, Hearn, like these are, but they're right down the, oh yeah, also there was a bunch of English former and greats, current, oh, future greats.
Yeah, so. Yeah, well, because that's not just only the order, because that's the order they're sitting in as well. So that's all spreading out from Harris, who's the chair. So he's in the important seat. And so, and there are cricketers further up, you know, like Johnny Douglas gets mentioned, Tennyson gets mentioned before you get to the messes. So if they say messes, that means they're a professional, most likely. But yeah, you do get down to this bit where you're just going through these. So you've got, this point where you get to Crawford, Bell, Hardinger, Woolley, Gunn, Hobbs, Hearn, and Hendren. I think that would be the end of the table you'd want to be sitting at. That's probably the more interesting end of the table with the professional cricketers rather than being up with the politicians.
Because it's Woolley, it's not the most famous Woolley. He is a very famous Woolley. Frank Woolley was, of course, the more famous of the two. But I think we talked about that in our last.
He's come up a few times. Yeah,
a few months ago.
Yeah, they kicked down the gates to get in when he took his 100th wicket for the season. There was I think it was at Trent Bridge, and they smashed open the gates and like a couple of thousand people waiting. I wanted to go see him take the 100th wicket. So, yeah. And a couple more. We're not done. In the vice chairs were Messrs. E.A. Tilley, C.V. Paul, H. Noel Hoare, H. Brevet, and S.H. Pardon. I don't think I know any of those. H. Noel Hoare, maybe. I think Tilley's come up before. Among those who were unavoidably absent were General Sir W.R. Birdwood, Lord Hawke, and the Marquis Camden, the President of the MCC, the Right Honourable H.W. Forster, MP, so that's the President of the MCC at that point, Messrs. D.C.F. Burton, F.E. Lacey, that Lacey is the Secretary of the MCC, J. Shooter, S.M.J. Woods, C.H.B. Marsham, J.C. White, Oscar Ashe, G.J. Hurst, and Dr. Russell Bencraft. So F.E. Frank Lacy, he is the secretary of the MCC. Howard Lacy is involved with the Mitcham Club. Howard Lacy is the manager, and Frank Lacy was quite important in the organisation of the tour. Howard Lacy, L-A-C-Y, Frank Lacy, L-A-C-E-Y, both of them spelt wrong a lot. This name's driving me nuts. Like, these are the two very important people in this story, and it is driving me insane. I actually have on my computer, I've actually got written who's who. It's like, yeah, Frank is Frank MCC, Howard AIF. It's, yeah, driving me nuts.
And of course, Lord Hawke is the other very famous name within that list. Again, like Harris, that person who'd been in English cricket for a really long time, so I think the president of Yorkshire, and made them such a force within those cricketing circles. And
the inventor of Yorkshire.
Essentially.
So this is another story I'm working on at the moment, is when Hawke comes along to Yorkshire. So before Hawke, Yorkshire cricket side was described as 10 drunks and a reverend, because there was a reverend on the side and he was a teetotaler and the rest of them were just his heads. And I think the reverend was like the only gentleman, the rest were all professional. So, and Lord Hawke comes into Yorkshire and he does all of this stuff for the players, winter pay, better pay. So he really improves the conditions.
And professionalism as well.
That's because the deal. It's like there's no more going to the pub in between overs as was common. No more rocking up to the game drunk. Yeah, you've got to play like professionals. So he's very important in the professionalisation of cricket.
Yeah, he sets up that contrast with Harris, who's obviously more of that establishment amateur the contrast. Obviously not there, but it's also interesting to see these names that go so far back into what we consider the cricket history that not right back into that amateur or early proto-professional era, but certainly back to the start of the first tours, that there's still, you see that continuity that through that the people that are there that were relatively young would still have influence almost in the 60s and 70s, whereas they were at dinners with people who had influence in the 1870s. This is that point.
I'm glad you brought this up, because this is actually the book. This is where the book started going. This is why the book's going back so far, is I want to try and tell this story using persons, or using people, and saying, like, telling the story from this perspective, and it's like, and then he meets this guy, and I'll switch to that perspective. And so, you know, for example, there's a game where you have, like, at the ground, you've got Tom Wills, William Hammersley, George Parr, Wisden, Lily White, like, Charlie Lawrence, William Caffin. So these names probably don't mean a lot to most people, but so Tom Wills we know as the founder of Australian football. William Hammersley is one of the guys who was part of that group who invented football. But Tom Wills is also like the first Victorian professional cricketer, and William Hammersley is this guy who comes out from England. He was connected to Lords, and he becomes very important in the Melbourne Cricket Club. And there's a big a lot of the early development of Victorian cricket is those two men and their relationship. They were very good friends for a long time, and then they have a big falling out. And the falling out between those two is part of what brings about the divide between administrators and players, which goes on to becoming the Big Six scandal, for example, eventually. But then, you know, Charlie Lawrence, so William Caffin, he's the Englishman who stays behind after the first English tour. Charlie Lawrence is the Englishman who stays behind after the second.
White Line Wireless. We eat, breathe, and sleep cricket. It's a medical condition. Send help.
You are a wanted man, running away from the police. Then.
Hey, and we're back. So, unfortunately, it looks like I've lost a whole bunch of stuff that we recorded. So, rather than trying to seamlessly jump back into it, I'm just going to sort of, I think what I was talking about was how there were these group of people and they all sort of spread out everywhere. And it's really sucks. I think we've lost about 20 minutes of great conversation, so which we're not going to be able to get back that easily. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to go back to Cow Corner's diaries, because there's a fair bit more to talk about, and hopefully that'll jog my memory on some of the conversations that we've had. So I've just read out the list of names, and now we will go back to Cow Corner. After a smartly served repast, the chairman, in submitting the royal toast, referred to two incidents which had illustrated the hold the monarchy happily held on the people. One was the remarkable display of enthusiasm outside Buckingham Palace on the night of Armistice Day. The other, the reception which the Prince of Wales had found awaiting him in the Canadian Dominion. I love that. So you've got to always do the royal toast. I find it one of the hardest things to... the hardest bits of historical empathy that I have to try and do is to try and put myself into the place of someone who, like, loves the sovereign. Like, I really, really struggle. And I struggle putting myself into the place of a lot of these professional cricketers in the 19th century. And it's like, just this understanding of the class structure being so firm and so set.
But this is actually interesting, because in some ways it's almost the opposite of that. It's almost insecure. You know, the monarchy, it's very popular. Yep. Did you see how popular it was after Armistice Day when they went to Canada? Oh, they were very popular. It's almost like they know deep in their heart, actually, it really shouldn't exist.
and that is totally the fragility of the, you know, this paternalistic patriarchal oligarchy that runs both the English Empire and cricket. Yeah, that's part of the fragility of it, which is one of the main themes I'm trying to explore here, is that they are constantly trying to seek approval, that they are as good as they tell everyone they are, you know, that we are this important, that the masses do love us this much. It's interesting, yeah. Lord Harris then rose again to propose the toast of the evening, the Australian cricket team, coupled with the name of their captain, Mr. H.L. Collins. He stated that the tourists had done better than they probably ever anticipated, and the captain, doubtless, had not a little to do with the success of the tour. The occasion was absolutely unique. Such an 11 had never toured England before, an 11 of cricketing soldiers. Their hosts had probably a twofold object in view. He expressed, in feeling terms, one, viz., the debt of gratitude we owed to the Australian Army, and regretted that General Birdwood had been unable to attend and state the facts of its heroism from personal experiences. Those who served with them knew, those who regretted they were not young enough to serve, so nevertheless looked upon them as comrades, and recognised the invaluable services they had rendered. You get this a lot. They're like, the old guys are like, oh, yes, I would have been a general because, you know, I'm Lord Fuckknuckle or something like that. Yes, I would have been there. And you know, that's, yeah, just because you would have, you know.
That's right.
That's where the army came from. The army came from the aristocrat.
I was busy during the Boer War, so I didn't.
Yeah. Because, I mean, that's probably worth sort of touching on, that before the First World War, not by now, but before the First World War, the English Army is almost the gentry and nobility. It's not very common for a lower class, a working class person to end up in the military. Navy maybe, but not in the army. Most of the army was, you know, third and fourth sons kind of stuff.
And it was very much that 19th century period of the army, that post-Napoleonic war thing, was this the army structured in this kind of, it's almost like maneuvers for the sake of maneuvers. No one really got shot except in the colonial era when all of the natives were obviously shot. But the army itself we're impregnable, and we just walk around and we show up arms and then we finish. And the First War was this massive shock to their system because it starts and then everyone gets shot. And the Boer War was a little bit of a shock to them because they went over there and this is in, what, 1902, I think, a period around that. But
89 to 03, that's sort of going on. Yeah.
They have this period.
99, sorry.
it's guerrilla warfare, and
yep.
it's not working to just walk around and bring in Australian soldiers to help them understand how to operate in a guerrilla environment. Mm. So it's funny like that you've got this army that's had to kind of completely remake its sense of how you should do war.
Yeah.
And the First World War is like, it's not like that. Yeah. It was hard.
Yeah, yeah. And we talked about that this a few times in this podcast, that what an Englishman thought of war was in 1913 is what we think war is would be closer to World War One than what an Englishman in 1913 would think war is. You know, like it is that different. Like it is, you know, and it'll be like whenever the first proper drone war happens and how it's just all of a sudden it's like, you know, when both sides are fighting with drone armies, it'll be like, okay, this is a new thing. This is not war as we know it anymore. Or, you know, maybe when people start, because, you know, like World War III started in 2007 and how we don't really talk about it. And it's because it's this new war, it's this cyber war that's been going on since Russia invaded Estonia in 2007. And it's just this, such a paradigm shift that you can't think of it in the same way. And, you know, for us, we don't see it. You know, we don't see this new paradigm shift, but for them it was, you know, it went from being boys' own adventure stories to horror, you know, yes. to, you know, to a slasher film kind of thing. It's, yeah, so I don't know. What's the boy Nancy Drew? I don't know. Boys' Own Adventure. That's a thing, Boys' Own Adventures. Anyway, but yeah, from that to Freddy Krueger kind of thing. All right. Where did I get up to? In addition, their hosts doubtless desired to do homage to the success of a team that did not only... Jesus Christ. People are hard to read sometimes. In addition, their hosts doubtless desired to do homage to the success of a team that not only did not pose as being representative of Australia, but not even of the Australian Army, several of whose best players have returned home, if that was the correct term to employ. I need to unpack that grammar a bit. Like, these aren't my words.
It needs more knots.
This is how people in 1919 wrote. So, yes. So what he's saying is that they're not saying that they're not the best in Australia. They're not even saying they're not the best in the Australian Army because, you know, Armstrong and Barber and Calloway have gone. So, yes, but it's just, yeah.
But they did very well.
Yes, they did very well. And then, yes, home, if that was the correct term to employ. So that's I find that interesting that Lord Harris doesn't know whether Australians are calling England home. He's like, you guys used to call this home. Do you still call this home? And that has something that actually had changed before the war to England not being as home, but then after the war, it's home again. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a big change that we get out of the war. They had been an idea on their part at first only to meet the amateurs of the counties. It was as well such a view was altered, or they would never have been got out. They had added to the interest in a season of experimental cricket, over which the authorities had been apprehensive, happily, unnecessarily. In conclusion, he referred to the value of cricket as cementing the bond of union between the mother country and the colonies.
We spoke about it at some length, but then lost it, but we should talk about it again.
Yeah.
Because the comment that I brought it to in the first instance was this idea that the Australian cricket team is at this dinner and Collins is sitting to the left at the most important place, and then the rest of the team is within these tables, but they're kind of ahead of the players. They're kind of within the gentry kind of section, the gentleman section, but not ahead of the normal cricket players. There's always been this weird tension for Australian cricket of how do we think about them in England.
That's right. That's what we were talking about.
Yeah. How did they – are they professionals? Yeah. Are they gentlemen?
Yeah.
Are they representative of Australia and we've got to fate them as such that they're like the rules of Australia, or do we have to fate them as a – because Australian cricketers, they're not like amateur cricketers in England. Amateur cricketers in England were upper class, and Australian cricketers are always a little bit rough, and there's always been this – they both feted them but also looked down on them as being not
quite. And it's because like Australia couldn't support professional cricketers. I think that has a lot to do with it, but yeah, there's just not enough games.
Or amateur cricketers because they didn't have enough gentry.
Yeah, but like, so there would have been a few professional, you know, there were professionals around, the guys doing the bowling at MCC and that MCG and that kind of thing. But it's not like England where every county had a few professionals and there were, you know, 30, 40, 50 guys earning sort of middle class wages to play cricket. And so no one in Australia could make their living out of cricket. So even if you were a really good cricketer, you had to have a job. But then no one in Australia had sort of the landed money to be able to afford to play cricket for free. So everyone had to be paid to play cricket. Like, you had to pay everyone's expenses. So they sort of all got lumped in with this one class, and then they go to England, like you said, and the English don't know how to treat them. But then alternatively, like in those first professional tours especially, the Australians would all treat the English as if they were, you know, aristocratic, even though they were in England, they were getting treated like crap. And they come out to Australia and everyone in Australia wants to, you know, sort of their own colonial power is not very legitimate. And so you're able to sort of share the legitimacy of, even though these, so you have the English cricket team along to a lunch and you go, well, look, you know, these are like the greatest gentlemen from back home. And whereas back home, they're professional dirt bags. But it's being able to take some of the legitimacy of cricket. You know, so you're taking a piece of Lords and having lunch with a piece of Lords when you're having lunch with these professional cricketers.
And for Harris, it's that civilizing effect of cricket. And I think, so one of the things I talked about before, and I'll restate it because it's interesting, I think, is this idea that if you look at the nations that play cricket and the nations that play football, soccer, right. It's always been a really interesting, there's a large piece of academic research of why did some nations do one and not the other. And the really interesting thing about cricket is that the nations who mostly play cricket are the countries that were closest and most colonialized by England, whereas the nations that end up playing football were the ones that were further away. Mm. And the reason for that is comes back to this statement by Harris around this cementing the bond thing, that cricket is this civilizing thing that you could take on, and it's to the harks back to test cricket, that we could prove ourselves as a nation by showing that we can match the amateurs of England who are the best cricketers in England by matching them.
And it actually gets written about as beating England at cricket is one of the first steps towards dominionhood.
That's right.
It is seriously talked about as, you know, that is that being able to beat England at cricket is showing you are able to govern yourself. You know, you have reached a point where you can govern yourself.
And cricket had spread throughout the world in the late 19th century, but it was always this upper class thing where it had to replicate itself as a very English thing. And then at the World War I, people said, I'm not sure we want to be English anymore. And it really fell away.
Yeah, it's definitely worldwide, the story in the Netherlands. That's what kills Dutch cricket.
But whereas football, soccer has always been this kind of upper middle class, and we just play it because it's fun and we don't have to prove ourselves, and it doesn't hark back to that. So the countries that actually play cricket, took cricket and became cricketing test nations are those nations that have that colonial mindset that we have to prove ourselves to England. It's the Indias and the West Indies and Australia and New Zealand.
So like Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, it's definitely like a colonial cringe. Mm. You know, you've got to prove yourself against the mother country. But then in India and Pakistan, and India especially, it's beating them at their own game.
Yeah.
It's different than what's – it's the same, different.
It's Suk Malega, yeah, so. It's all colonialism, but it's different colonialism.
Yeah. But so – and so it takes that – and I love the way that the Indians all take the game of the English gentry, and then the English gentry take the game of the Indian aristocracy, which is polo, and – yeah, swap, basically. Yeah, I always find that really funny. One of the things that, in terms of cricket as a civilizing force, and I'm pretty sure I haven't spoken about this, I think this is the bit that we lost, is that there is this paternalistic patriarchal oligarchy at the top. And I use all those words because it's something that needs to really be seen as intersectional. It's not just class. It's not just race. It's not just gender. It is all of these things and more that makes you into that ruling elite. And the way these ruling elite look at the people below them is, so for example, the way they're looking at Indigenous people and working class people is very similar in a lot of ways. There is definitely a racial hierarchy that they buy into as well. But a really good example is, I've been reading through like 1860s, 1870s Australia recently, and have come across William Hammersley, who I mentioned earlier, is one of the founders of Australian football and a big man in the MCG. Him talking about Unaremin, or Johnny Muller, who's one of the Aboriginal, the best of the Aboriginal cricketers from 1868, and probably the best all-rounder of the mid-19th century, until Grace comes along. So Grace is sort of coming out at that stage. So, yeah, so he's in that. He's proper good.
So even better than Wills in that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. It is interesting. There's a number of people say he's the best cricketer they've ever seen play in England and Australia. He's impressive. But he gets a gig at the MCG as the professional bowler. And the way, so Hammersley, like the race never comes up. It's never an issue. The only time race is ever an issue to Hammersley is when he has a go at, I think it was someone from Geelong, either from the Geelong club, who refused to play against the Aboriginal team because they were Aboriginal. And he like cracked it at him and was like, you know, this is, it's just not cricket, basically. Because Unaremin had come from, you know, he was born pre-contact. So he had seen his entire nation wiped out, essentially. And he's one of the last of his kind. And occupied people, one of the ways you respond to occupation is to become very, very deferential, you know, so you don't get killed. And so Unaremin was very, very deferential. And so around the club, he was, yes, sir, no, sir, three bags full, sir, you know, doff the cap to the gents and that kind of thing. And so Hammersley really, really likes him. And he's like, this is the perfect example of cricket civilizing. And, you know, he knows how to behave, and he's cracking it at the other Melbourne professionals, including Tom Wills, because Tom Wills never showed him any respect because they were mates. Like, it's interesting. They sort of came up through, because Wills went to rugby school, and so he would have first met Hammersley when Wills was at rugby and Hammersley was at Cambridge or at Oxbridge, one of the two. And so they've come up through that system, and then come out to Australia, and Tom Wills is just some farmer's son, whereas Hammersley, not really worth anything, but he's got a name, and so he's a gentleman. And just the way Hammersley talks about Unaremin compared to the other professionals, it really shows how what they were interested in was the people knowing their place, and that we are above you, and you've got to know your place. Yeah, the civilizing nature of cricket.
And I guess back to this idea that the Australian cricket team, it's
the bond.
There's this bond that's formed through cricket, and they're almost one of us because home is here, and they've proven this by showing that they're good at cricket. Mm.
Yeah, and like you've got to remember, like cricket tours. I'm not sure if we lost this talking about it before, but cricket tours are probably one of the main places of cultural transfer in the 19th century, like which is cricket in general. Like newspapers are getting shared back and forth, you know, across South Africa and New Zealand as well, but it's largely Australia and England. But then you're getting groups of 12 at a time going out, travelling around to all the places, meeting all of the people, and then going home. Like, that didn't happen for any other reason. There's people went to England and did that, but no one went out to Australia for 3 months and travelled around and then went home. It happened, but it wasn't really a thing. If you were going to Australia, you were going to stay there usually. Whereas here you have a big group of people who are moving through the centres of power. In colonial Australia, all the important. It's like, for example, the early Victoria New South Wales games, they used to suspend Parliament. So it's, you know, it's an important social meeting point. And so all of these guys coming in from England and then vice versa going back to England, and that sharing of cultural transfer. So it's a big place where that bond of empire goes in, but also going back to that professional, amateur, don't know where they fit. I think that's why cricket, because I get a lot of flack from other people in the history department as to cricket being an important part of Australian culture. And it's like so much of this early development of Australian identity is going on around these cricket teams with these very important people around. And so it's, yeah, it is a place of cultural transfer and culture creation. All right, back to Cow Corner. The team would carry away with them the most kindly recollections of their tour. Any success achieved, in which was largely due to the unselfish spirit of the side who worked as a team and not for themselves. Captain Warner added his need of praise to the Australian team, not only for the good cricket they played, but they were a team of thorough sportsmen. And sportsman is a word that has moral connotations, not physical connotations. Yep. Yes, being a thorough sportsman is akin to being a gentleman. The Imperial Orchestra played during the dinner, and an excellent musical entertainment was contributed by Miss Annie Beattle, Messrs. Robert Pitt, Edward Dykes, Langton Merck, and Jock Walker, with Mr. Douglas Rogers at the piano. It was a memorable and most enjoyable gathering. One of those guys sang with Melba, but other than that, I couldn't work out who any of those people were. The Australian military authorities are to be congratulated on the successful tour of the AIF 11, and English cricketers are indebted to them for stepping into the breach when the negotiations for a representative Australian side came to nothing. The team made friends wherever they went, and were very popular, as indeed they deserve to be, for they are an extremely nice lot of men who play the game enthusiastically.
It's almost demeaning, that's it. Okay. It's almost demeaning.
Yeah. Like,
you were very sporty and you played very well, and you were very popular. Like,
right, yeah, yeah. So it's this paternalism. You cannot escape the paternalism of cricket and this paternalistic attitudes. And yes, it's absolutely patronising them. Absolutely. Okay, so finally it was time to board the Ascanius to tour South Africa. Finally it was time to board the Ascanius to South Africa, from where I am writing this final note before handing it on to a friend from the sportsman to distribute. The witching hour is not a convenient time for attending a London terminus to bid bon voyage, and it is no surprise to find the cricket community conspicuous by absence. Well, I guess they were all at the dinner the night before by the sound of it, eh? Yet there is a goodly gathering of personal friends and much cheeriness. Some of the travellers had been on a pleasure bent till the last and came straight from the theatre, while Ernie Cameron busied himself with the safe storage of the baggage. The bustle attendant on departure is not the most convenient time for interviewing, but my friend is persevering with a chat with the skipper conducted through the window of the compartment. We are anticipating with pleasure our visit to South Africa, which would have been out of the question but for the guarantee by Sir Abe Bailey and the fact that they were able to make the voyage by troopship. This will probably be the means also by which we will complete the journey home. A certain number of South Africans being sent to the Cape and their berths then utilised by the cricketers. This might involve a slightly longer stay in South Africa, but we hope to be back in Australia before the close of the year. At this point, we can say nothing definite as to the program, though we expect to play about 10 matches. It would be an excellent idea if on our arrival home, we could tackle the rest of Australia in, say, a series of 3 games. Such a step would prove most interesting and especially be valuable in event of a team for England materialising next year. My weekly reports will cease for a time as we sail, but I look forward to sharing with you all the excitement of our African tour post-haste.
I love the use of media for advertising for someone to play against. Kind of a, oh, this idea's come up. someone should take that on, and then hoping that it kind of becomes a thing by the time they get home, that they'll be able to have these matches organised. And
yeah, so this bit was originally written by the quote-unquote friend. So there was one journalist on the docks to see him off, and I've ripped off his words. So he's writing that. I'm pretty sure this is the first mention of a series of three games in Australia. And so, yeah, this probably is the genesis of, yeah, then when they go home, the military brass decide that it's a good idea to go, because they eventually go up playing New South Wales and Queensland. Yeah.
Because Abe Bailey, significant cricketer in Serbian cricket, significant cricketer in the ICC as well.
Very significant. He's one of my main characters.
And, yeah. So I'm sure you'll have much more to say about him, but he's that person who came, who basically convinced them to create the what became the Imperial Cricket Conference, yep. The ICC,
yep.
and to play that first tri-match series in 1990.
Yeah, it's absolutely, it's a Bailey joint, 100%. But so Bailey is business partners with Harris, I think. Could be Hawke. I always get the two mixed up. They are in my brain. I know one of them is north, one of them is south. Hawke is north and Harris is south, but I forget which one. I'm pretty sure it's Harris. Could be Hawke. Actually, unsure, totally unsure. One of those two is in the gold mining game with Bailey. So there's even that connection there as well. It's one of the reasons why I focus so much on these cultural connections, and why this to pick this tour is because I want to get South Africa in there as well. I don't want to do just an Australia-England transfer, because that's, you know, it's sort of been done a lot. We understand how the colony interacts with the metropolis. So I was very much more interested in how the colonies are interacting with each other as well. And Abe Bailey is sort of, he's the conduit there. Before him, the Logan is the lead of Matches Fontaine or whatever. So there's him who's important in the earlier on in the 19th century. But Abe Bailey mates with Cecil Rhodes as well. Cecil Rhodes, quite big in the South African cricket story. So one of the English teams, one of the very first English teams to go there, play a game to celebrate the Pioneers Column leaving. So the Pioneers Column is the group of soldiers that Cecil Rhodes led off to conquer what is, you know, now Zimbabwe and that. So it's interesting how these people pop up and goes to that bond of empire.
Well, yeah, and like the populations were much smaller, and the number of people in the upper echelon is not enormous. They did all know each other, and it was hard to avoid that.
Actually, that reminds me, that's totally the point I was trying to make earlier when talking about the civilizing force of cricket, is the reason why indigenous people didn't go on, so Parsis in India, and especially Malays in South Africa, but Africans as well, but their motivation to play cricket was that it got them an in with these aristocratic quote unquote classes. And India's the best place to look at this.
And also the colonial administration, which again wasn't big, because there's a few thousand people running something that actually needed several hundred thousand people.
Yeah, not even.
Potentially.
Yeah. Yeah, the list of names, like that's why, and this is why doing this is where you're looking at who's crossing over is very, because there is only like 100 people running the world at this point. You know, it is, and some of them are at this dinner. It is that kind of small incestuous group. But in India, it's a really good place to look at it, because the Parsis are the Parsis of Bombay, Mumbai now. So Parsis aren't Indian. Parsis are the Iranians, the Zoroastrian Iranians that came down 1,000 years ago. And so they were already isolated in that sort of that western coast of India, with sort of Mumbai up to Gujarat kind of thing. And they're all the merchant class, which is what happens when you become an outsider very, very often, is you become the merchant class. And the English come in and they set up their colonial administrations. And colonial administration in India was very much about just having a few dudes sitting in a fort with good relations with the princes. And so the Parsis, who were the merchants, see that the way to get access to the wealthy people, not just the English, but the wealthy Indians as well, is to become friends with the English, because they will let them get access to the rich people. And the way you do that is you go and play cricket with them. And it's exactly the same in South Africa, that playing cricket was a way to get into the middle class if you were black or Malay. Because especially, and because the racial stuff in South Africa doesn't happen, and it's there. It's not real important till late 19th century. So Australian apartheid starts well before South African apartheid. South African apartheid legislation is actually copied from Australian apartheid legislation. So it's sort of the 1860s, 1870s, 1880s in South Africa. There is actually quite a lot of black people and Asian people playing cricket, because that was access to the middle class. And it's sort of around the turn of the century. There's a guy, Crom Hendricks, who's a big flashpoint. But he's also caught up in the dispute between Western Province and Transvaal, so Cape Town and Johannesburg. It's one of these fights over control that I'm examining in my book, because it's another one. It's like the South African, not so much the Big Six controversy, more like the English professional dispute I was sort of explained to you earlier with George Parr and Burrup from Surrey. That sort of goes on in South Africa as well. And one of the results is black people aren't allowed to play cricket anymore. Yeah. All right. Well, that's actually it from Cow Corner this week. And there's now going to be a break for the best part of a month while these guys are on a ship. But that doesn't mean we're going to be without podcasts, because starting next week, for the next 3 weeks, we're going to look at a series of topics that are important in 1919. So we're going to have a look at the Treaty of Versailles, very much about the end of empire. We're going to have a look at the women's suffrage movement mainly in the UK. We're looking at the suffragettes in the UK, because it's a nice tight pack story. And we're also going to look at what's called the Red Flag Riots in Brisbane that happen around this time as well, which is some early communist activity in Australia. So hopefully you'll enjoy those 3 weeks. They're different format, trying a different thing. I'll be interested to see how you like them, because that might be something that I take off in another direction in the future. Any closing thoughts on today, Russ?
No, I don't think so. We covered a pretty broad range of topics in the end.
I think so. I'm sorry that we've lost. I think we lost about 25 minutes there at one point, and
I think we got most of it back.
I think we've come around to most of it, but if it does feel like we jumped around a little bit in that second half, it's because we've been trying to come back to that conversation that we lost. But that will do from me today. Please tweet at me at anthcondon. Email me anthony@anthonycondon.com. Just a reminder, this is part of my PhD thesis. So any criticism or feedback is actually really useful. It gives me something to write about later. That'll do for now. We'll be back with more cricket in a month. Be back in a week with some politics. And we will see you then. Thank you very much and goodbye.
DNA. So when they start to play and you want to know and you can't find the call on the radio, call the White Line Wireless.
White Line Wireless.
White Line Wireless.
White Line Wireless.
Just one click to hear it all.
Boba, boba, bloody bow.
The main of every true blue fan is the Bandex cricketer anchorman. It's the same old words in the same old voice.
Bloody ball.